content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service would like to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the October 28th, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Trump claims the election is rigged. What happened? Facing sliding poll numbers and a slew of sexual assault allegations, Donald Trump claimed this week that the election is being rigged against him, sparking fears about how he and his supporters will react if he loses on November 8th. The Republican nominee repeatedly tweeted and told rallies over the past week that the election was being stolen from him through large-scale voter fraud, biased media coverage, and a conspiracy of international banks and globalist elites who want to put Hillary Clinton in office to enrich her donors and erode U.S. sovereignty. He urged his supporters to watch your polling booths, particularly in inner-city areas. Election officials warned that Trump's rhetoric, unprecedented in recent American political history, could lead to racial confrontations at polling places. And President Obama mocked the Republican nominee for whining before the game's even over. A Politico Morning Consult poll found that 73% of Republicans think that the election could be stolen from Trump by widespread voter fraud. Trump's talk of a rigged election came as his campaign was battered by the public statements of 10 women who came forward to accuse him of kissing, groping, and sexually assaulting them. The Republican nominee fiercely denied all the allegations and claimed the media was airing them as part of a coordinated effort with Hillary Clinton's campaign. At his rallies, a number of Trump supporters said they were ready to take up arms if his opponent wins. "I hope we can start a coup," 50-year-old contractor Dan Bowman told a reporter in Cincinnati. "Clinton should be in prison or shot." David Clark, a Milwaukee sheriff who spoke at the Republican National Convention, ominously tweeted that it was pitchforks and torches time. On the eve of the third presidential debate, which took place after the week went to press, Clinton's lead over Trump in the Real Clear Politics national poll average swelled to 6.6 points. The Democratic nominee also had a substantial lead in most of the key swing states, including Florida, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina, and even drew level in traditionally red Arizona. What the editorial said: "Trump's conspiracy theory is complete and utter bunk," said NationalReview.com. "The U.S. electoral process is controlled by local officials in 50 states, and vote counting is heavily scrutinized by officials of both parties and independent monitors. Yes, there's no doubt that the press hates Donald Trump with a passion, or that Hillary Clinton is spectacularly unfit for the office of president because of her reckless airing of state secrets through private emails. But if she wins, it will be because she was chosen by the American electorate. This is dangerous demagoguery, even for Trump," said the Los Angeles Times. "The presumption that elections are fair and that the loser will accept the outcome is what makes possible the peaceful transition of power. It is the cornerstone of a stable and functioning democracy. Sadly, Trump is just recycling the fear-mongering about virtually non-existent voter fraud that Republican state officials and lawmakers have used as a pretext to pass voter ID laws designed to make it harder for minorities, the poor, and college students to vote. No presidential candidate should portray U.S. elections as illegitimate," said the Wall Street Journal. "But spare us the liberal freakout. Senator Bernie Sanders' entire presidential campaign was based on the idea that the economy is rigged. Senator Elizabeth Warren mentioned the rigged system no fewer than five times in her Democratic National Convention speech. And does anyone really dispute Trump's claim that the press corps is nearly unanimous against him? What the columnist said, Trump is making quite a closing argument for his campaign, said Michael Gerson in the Washington Post. He has sneered at the looks of women who have accused him of sexual assault and promised to throw Clinton in jail if he wins. Now he's undermining the reputation of American democracy. Trump is clearly completely unmoored from restraining influences and is frighteningly unstable under pressure, disqualifying traits in a would-be president. Trump's warning about international bankers conspiring against American sovereignty sounds like a dog whistle rendition of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, said Eric Levitz in nymag.com. He's telling his angriest followers that their America is being stolen by dark foreign forces. What if some of these Second Amendment enthusiasts decide to emulate their founding fathers and take up arms to overthrow an illegitimate tyrant? Fears over Trump's rabble-rousing are overblown, says Ross Douthat in the New York Times. If he loses by a landslide, a strong possibility, his to-the-barricades ranting will look ridiculous, even to his deepest-dyed supporters. Besides, Trump base largely consists of senior citizens, not the testosterone-addled young. How great is their appetite for violent confrontation in the streets? Nevertheless, the GOP should prepare for the worst, said Noah Rothman in CommentaryMagazine.com. What happens if, on election night, Trump refuses to concede? Or if he claims the result was falsified and that Hillary Clinton is no legitimate president? Congressional Republicans and party leaders should be ready to step forward to concede the election to Clinton and ensure a peaceful transition of power. They cannot allow themselves to be complicit in this act of civic vandalism. And a second main story. U.S. strikes back at Yemeni rebels. What happened? The U.S. was dragged deeper into Yemen's civil war last week when a U.S. warship fired Tomahawk missiles at three radar installations in territory controlled by Iran-backed Houthi rebels, shortly before the start of a 72-hour ceasefire in the country. The strikes were in retaliation for failed missile attacks launched from rebel-held areas against the USS Mason in the Red Sea. And they marked the Pentagon's first direct bombing in Yemen since the conflict began 19 months ago. Until now, the U.S. has limited itself to providing logistical support to a Saudi-led coalition of Sunni Arab countries, which are waging a bombing campaign against the Shiite Houthis in a bid to restore Yemeni President Abdrabbu Mansour Hadi to power. Hadi fled to the southern port city of Aden last year after the Houthis seized the capital of Sana'a. At least 4,000 Yemeni civilians have been killed since the war began. Aid groups said they hoped this week's ceasefire would help alleviate a growing humanitarian crisis in Yemen, where 2 million people have been displaced and 80% of the population relies on aid. Days before the ceasefire, the U.S. said it was reviewing its already significantly reduced support to the Saudis after coalition aircraft targeted a Sana'a funeral hall and killed 140 people. Coalition officials later blamed bad information for the strike. What the columnist said, what if the U.S. went to war and nobody here even noticed, said Mustafa Bayoumi in TheGuardian.com. That's exactly what happened last week in divided and desperately poorer Yemen when the Obama administration ramped up America's military involvement without so much as a policy debate or public discussion. Actually, the U.S. has been embroiled in Yemen's chaos for months, thanks to its appalling role in Saudi Arabia's utterly vicious bombing campaign, said Zach Bocamp in Vox.com. Using U.S.-sold weapons, U.S. provided jet fuel and U.S. collected intelligence. The Saudis have been destroying hospitals, water bottling factories, and now funeral homes. They have also imposed a blockade on a country that imports 90% of its food, leaving children literally starving to death. Obama had every right to launch missile strikes, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The attack on the USS Mason from Houthi-controlled territory was no laughing matter. The warship had to use active defense, including interceptor missiles, to prevent a strike that could have killed dozens of sailors. Besides, Obama must send a signal to the Houthis' Iranian masters. As in Syria, Tehran is using Yemen's civil war as another front in its campaign to become the dominant power in the Middle East. There's one clear winner in this mess, Al-Qaeda, said Barbara Slavin in VOAnews.com. Although ISIS gets the headlines, Al-Qaeda's Yemeni offshoot, AQAP, has been a major source of terrorist plots against the West, including the 2009 underwear bomb plot and the Charlie Hebdo massacre. Now the group has capitalized on the chaotic fighting to seize territory it can use as a base for new attacks. As a recent Jamestown Foundation study concluded, the future for AQAP has rarely looked brighter. And our controversy of the week, Clinton, what the WikiLeaks emails reveal. Hillary Clinton's allies in the media are trying to bury the news, said Kimberly Strassel in the Wall Street Journal. But the nation now has proof of pretty much everything she has been accused of. The activist group WikiLeaks this week released another trove of internal emails from Clinton's campaign, stolen, say intelligence officials, from the account of Clinton aide John Podesta by hackers working for the Russian government. Among the flurry of bombshells, the emails show Podesta and other aides colluding with psychophantic journalists to give her favorable coverage, mocking needy Latinos and Republicans drawn to Catholicism's severely backwards gender relations, and fretting over her insistence on dismissing her private email server scandal as a trivial mistake. In paid speeches, Clinton assures those writing the checks of her support for big banks, fracking, and fossil fuels, while saying that environmentalists need to get a life. The WikiLeaked emails reveal the Democratic nominee as smug and utterly phony, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. In private, she was perfectly comfortable with the globe-trotting financiers throwing six-figure speaking fees at her, while in public she tossed boob bait at her party's inflamed left-wing activist. Had Republicans not nominated the self-destructive Donald Trump, her campaign would now be in shambles. Americans better pay attention to what those emails reveal before it's too late, said Michael Wash in NYPost.com. In one of the $225,000 speeches she made to investment bank Goldman Sachs, Clinton says, "My dream is a hemispheric common market with open trade and open borders, a chilling prospect for Americans who value their jobs and their sovereignty." In another, she says that in politics, you need both a public and a private position, a nice summary of the two-facedness that has defined her career. Here's the real bottom line of what the WikiLeaks emails reveal, said Doyle McManus in LATimes.com. Like her very successful husband, Clinton is a pragmatic, center-left Democrat who believes in progressive goals, but who's willing to trim them, postpone them, even throw them under the bus, temporarily anyway, when practical politics requires. Is anyone really shocked? In the 10,000 emails WikiLeaks has published, there's no real smoking gun. Yes, she was chummy with the Goldman Sachs crowd, but also told them that bankers have to be held accountable for wrongdoing. And while she may dream of an America with open borders on trade, the trade and immigration policies she has actually proposed are totally mainstream. As for Clinton's statement that it was necessary for politicians to have both a public and private position while making the sausage of policy, said Joe Klein in Time, she's 100% correct. That's an essential, uncontroversial truth about how things work in a democracy, or how they used to, when presidents and Congress actually compromised and solved problems instead of battling to a standstill over ideology. You know what's most troubling about the WikiLeaks emails, asked Charles Lane in WashingtonPost.com? It's that we're reading them at all. As a general principle, transparency is necessary for a healthy democracy, but there's nothing healthy about one candidate's emails being stolen and selectively publicized by a totally non-transparent organization of computer hackers working for a hostile foreign government. What if this were to happen in every election? If Russia is deliberately trying to affect the outcome of the presidential race, said USA Today in an editorial, then the very heart of American democracy, our fair and open elections, has been attacked. That harm, if confirmed, will last far longer than memories of the content of particular emails. And for our good week, bad week shorts, it was a good week for encores after Michael Jackson topped Forbes' annual list of highest-earning dead celebrities. The King of Pop took in $825 million in pre-tax earnings over the past 12 months due to the sale of his music catalog, more than any performer, living or dead. It was a good week for little devils after researchers in Australia revealed that the milk produced by Tasmanian devils can be used to fight antibiotic-resistant superbugs like MRSA. It was a good week for trolling the trolls after a prankster created a fake document from the Clinton campaign listing a $330,000 payment to the Black Panthers and $30,000 to the Sharia Law Center for voter suppression, and a $760,000 payment for rigged polls. Trump supporters widely shared it on Twitter and Facebook. It was a bad week for marketing ploys after a restaurant in Guiyang, China, lost $15,000 in a single week with a pay-what-you-want campaign. I just don't understand why customers haven't come back after the promotion ended, one of the owners said. And it was a bad week for free time after a Texas man allegedly staged his own kidnapping so that he could hang out with friends without his wife's permission. Rogelio Andaverde arranged to be taken from his home at gunpoint by two masked intruders as his terrified wife looked on. And it was a bad week for the Fourth Estate after news agencies in the UK announced that robot journalists would soon be used to cover sports, business, and election results. A spokesman for the press association that said that automated storytellers wouldn't replace humans, but that on certain stories, they might prove more accurate. We're on the briefing page now. The battle for Mosul. ISIS seized Iraq's second largest city 2 years ago. Now a U.S.-supported coalition is fighting to take it back. Why is the attack happening now? Because Iraq's military is finally ready to go on the offensive. Government forces were humiliated by ISIS in June 2014 when some 1,500 jihadists stormed Mosul and routed 20,000 Iraqi soldiers, many of whom panicked and fled, leaving behind their U.S.-supplied weapons and Humvees. Since then, the Obama administration has focused on rebuilding and retraining Iraq's demoralized and dysfunctional army so that it can capture and hold territory without the help of large numbers of U.S. ground troops or Iran-backed Iraqi Shiite militias. It's crucial that the Iraqi military lead the way in Sunni-majority Mosul because Shiite militias have previously been accused of killing and abusing Sunni civilians. Atrocities in Mosul could spark a new sectarian uprising against the Shiite-dominated government in Baghdad. So the battle for Mosul will be headed in part by the Iraqi army's 15th Division, which was created after the losses of 2014. Many of its soldiers were members of the units that collapsed in Mosul, and they're hungry for redemption, says Michael Knights, an Iraq expert at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. The guys who ran away are coming back. What's the battle plan? The offensive is being fought on two fronts. About 4,000 Kurdish Peshmerga are fighting to retake a string of ISIS-held villages east of Mosul. With support from U.S. warplanes, artillery, and special operations commandos. The main attack is being launched from Kayara Air Base, some 40 miles south of Mosul, where 560 U.S. military advisors, 22,000 Iraqi government troops, and 6,000 mainly Sunni tribal fighters have gathered in recent months. Backed by coalition air support, liberation forces will advance along the Tigris River, clearing ISIS from towns and villages before reaching the city's edge in early November. Experts say the main urban battle will probably last through December. Much of the battle could be fought street to street and house to house. The winding narrow streets of Mosul's old city are inaccessible to tanks or artillery. Is ISIS ready for the assault? Its roughly 5,000 fighters in the city have spent months creating an elaborate network of defenses. IEDs have been hidden underneath roads and in buildings, and five bridges have been rigged with explosives. Residents told Reuters.com that a 6-foot-wide, 6-foot-deep moat has been dug around Mosul's perimeter, which will be filled with oil and set on fire, creating plumes of smoke to make it difficult for warplanes to spot targets. To evade airstrikes, ISIS is funneling men and equipment through underground tunnels. Former Iraqi finance and foreign minister Hashiar Zebari says militants are shaving their beards to blend in with the population and constantly moving their headquarters around. The jihadists are desperately trying to boost their numbers. Local men who refuse to take up arms have had their ears cut off, and locals say children as young as 8 have been handed pistols and knives in order to spy on citizens. I taught my 7-year-old all about autism to avoid being recruited, says one resident. Will the city's fall hurt ISIS? With about 1 million remaining residents, Mosul is the most populous city held by ISIS, and its loss will deprive the jihadists of a key source of tax revenue. A defeat in Mosul will also deliver a potentially fatal blow to the extremist dream of creating a large caliphate, across existing nations' borders. At its peak in 2014, ISIS controlled up to 40% of Iraq. Thanks to U.S.-led coalition airstrikes and ground attacks by Iraqi troops and paramilitary fighters, that number has shrunk to 10% today. Mosul's location near oil fields, key trading routes, and the Syrian border makes it even more critical. Experts believe that jihadist group's Syrian capital, Raqqa, will be easier to retake once its supply routes from Iraq have been severed. What will happen in Mosul after ISIS is ousted? The first challenge will be to stabilize the city and restore trust among its mosaic of sectarian, tribal, and ethnic groups. U.S. and Iraqi officials have spoken of establishing 8 self-governing areas in and around Mosul. These tasks may prove to be more difficult than the battle itself, Knight says. Turkey, a mostly Sunni nation, has some 2,000 troops and 24 tanks deployed at a base near Mosul and plans to keep them there for another year, supposedly to fight terrorist organizations, but also to deter Iraq's Shiite-led government from repressing Mosul Sunnis. Iraqi Prime Minister Haber Haider al-Abadi has warned Turkey that a continued military presence could spark a regional war. The more pressing worry for Mosul's residents, though, is the humanitarian crisis that's almost certain to unfold after liberation. How bad will it get? Relief agencies say the battle for Mosul will trigger a mass exodus. Many of the city's remaining residents are expected to flee at once, leaving their possessions behind. "We're facing this enormous tsunami coming at us," said Lisa Grand, the United Nations Humanitarian Coordinator for Iraq. Coalition forces will have to screen out jihadists from the refugees, and with some 3.3 million Iraqis already displaced by violence, overstretched aid agencies will struggle to feed and house all of Mosul's desperate civilians. Says Matthew Norrie of U.S. relief group Samaritan's Purse, "This is going to be a very large-scale catastrophe." And we'll read some of the best columns. The first two are from the U.S., starting with, "The founders were no less divided." Both Republicans and Democrats are fond of citing the lofty principles of America's founding fathers, said historian Alan Taylor. But the truth is that instead of offering a single cohesive and enduring vision for America, the founders were bitterly divided and the politics of the era even more rancorous and shrill than today's. In the early days of the Republic, Thomas Jefferson's Republicans favored a decentralized country with a weak federal government. Alexander Hamilton's Federalists preferred a powerful centralized state that could develop the U.S. into a major economic and military power. This fundamental disagreement produced conflicts so violent they would shock us today. Partisans and journalists shot one another in duels over insults, which is, of course, how Hamilton met his end. Political rivals had frequent fistfights or beat each other bloody in the street with canes. Political campaigns were rife with personal insults, sexual gossip, and other dirty tricks. Today we put the founders on an imaginary pedestal so we can masochistically rebuke ourselves for having such petty politicians. But our first leaders were deeply flawed too, and they had largely the same arguments. We are not to blame for the clashing over the diverse principles that the founders wove into an ambiguous constitution. The end of an era for football. NFL ratings just fell off a cliff, said Derek Thompson. This season, football viewer numbers are down double digits across the board, hitting Fox, CBS, NBC, and ESPN alike. One explanation is the Godzilla of the 2016 presidential race, which has siphoned off tens of millions of primetime viewers, especially when the debates went up against games. Then there's the 40% overall decline of cable viewership among teenagers and young 20-somethings. But there's something deeper at work here. It appears we've entered the twilight of a golden age of football. The NFL now has few popular superstars who appeal to national audiences, and the league has suffered some damaging public relations battles. The ongoing concussion problem and the league's attempt to hide the brain damage suffered by hundreds of former players has tainted the sport in the eyes of some fans. Colin Kaepernick's race-centered protest of the national anthem, which many other players have joined, have turned off other fans. If football ratings don't rise after the election, it will indicate that viewers are tuning out for a simple reason. They just don't think they'll have much fun watching. And how they see us column from Syria. Abandoning the people of Aleppo. The humanitarian carnage in Aleppo will leave an indelible stain on President Obama, said Derek Burney and Finn Osler Hampson in the Globe and Mail from Canada. The relentless bombardment of the city's rebel-held eastern areas by the Syrian regime and its ally Russia has killed thousands of civilians, including hundreds of children. Some 250,000 people, 100,000 of whom are kids, are still trapped in the opposition redoubt. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has engaged in endless Syrian peace negotiations with Russia and has repeatedly called for an end to the horrific onslaught. Yet Russian President Vladimir Putin and Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad have been able to ignore Kerry because of the Obama administration's reluctance to back diplomacy with force. Putin, by contrast, has been decisive. He knows what he wants, to gain respect at home by striking a strategic blow against the West. He's doing that, and Syrian children's bodies keep piling up. That's a lie, says Yevgeny Shestakov from Russia. Just as the Western media faked atrocities in Ukraine and blamed them on Russian forces, so now they are faking civilian deaths in Syria. Western media outlets have long been thoroughly infiltrated by the CIA and so-called humanitarian groups inside Syria are on the CIA payroll. The recent viral video of a 5-year-old Syrian boy covered in dust and sitting with unnatural calm after supposedly being dug out of a rubble in Aleppo by the White Helmets group was clearly staged. In fact, Russia takes incredible care to target only terrorists and not harm ordinary Syrians in eastern Aleppo. Just this week, it announced a humanitarian pause to its bombing campaign so that civilians could safely leave the city. You can't negotiate with a Russia that consistently lies. So what is Obama supposed to do exactly? Asked Jonathan Friedland in The Guardian. Imposing a no-fly zone unilaterally over Aleppo would be a declaration of war on Russia as well as on Assad. Everyone feels sorry for the Syrians, but nobody wants World War III. If we can't reach a long-lasting ceasefire, which seems to be the case, the least worst option may be for Syrian government forces to retake the whole city. At least the hungry, war-battered residents of eastern Aleppo would get the chance to rebuild their lives. So Putin wins, said Marwan Bishara in AlJazeera.com. Russia has been using negotiations as a stalling tactic all along, engaging in polite multinational discussions in Switzerland while its overwhelming firepower helps Assad recapture more territory. And Moscow has made it clear it won't give up in the negotiations what it won on the ground. Aleppo reveals the moral bankruptcy of international politics, said Aya Abu Shakara and Ashark al-Aswat from the UK. Russia covers for Assad's genocide, while the U.S. sulks and walks away. The Obama administration is simply leaving to its successors all the consequences of its failures. The Last Word article this week is titled, The Math Whiz Who Plays in the NFL. When the Baltimore Ravens' John Urschel isn't blocking defensive linemen, he's pursuing a Ph.D. in mathematics, said Michael Rosenwald. But his family and friends are worried that years of headbanging will damage his brain. On the football field, lining up John Urschel across from Tanguy Ringor would be unfair and possibly lethal. Urschel, a Baltimore Ravens offensive lineman, is 6'3" and weighs more than 300 pounds. Ringor, a grandmaster chess player known as the Belgian Butcher, is a flight risk in a sharp wind. Across the chessboard, they are better-matched opponents. Urschel is pursuing a Ph.D. in math at MIT during the off-season and last year published a paper titled A Cascadic Multigrid Algorithm for Computing the Fielder Vector. Ringor is studying economics at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, and captains its powerhouse chess team, which has won 6 national collegiate championships. Squaring off recently, the 25-year-old lineman surveyed the board, then pushed one of his pieces into a problem. Finally, the butcher said, making a move that knocked Urschel back to his goal line, I kept thinking, when will he make a mistake? Urschel resigned, offering his enormous right hand across the board. There is no equally civilized move in football, and for that, Urschel is thankful. The non-contact world of chess is where he exercises his brain, and his vicious competitiveness when he's not blocking blitzes or solving problems in applied mathematics. You can get the adrenaline going by playing chess, Urschel told Butcher and other UMBC chess players, but there's a difference. There's nothing like the adrenaline on the football field where a guy is trying to beat the mess out of me, and I'm trying to beat the mess out of him. The difference, taking on beasts, not pawns, worries his family, math mentors, and chess buddies as the reported number of ex-National Football League players suffering from brain damage increases. More than 40% of retired players showed signs of traumatic brain injury, a study released earlier this year found. Some have even killed themselves. What Urschel's relatives and friends sometimes wonder will be left of his brain when he retires to pursue a scholarly career in math. Is his four-year, $2.3 million contract worth the possible long-term costs? I think it is a valid concern, and I have talked to him about it, said Ludmil Zikatanov, a math professor at Penn State University, where Urschel earned his bachelor's and master's degrees. It is obvious he is very talented in math and will one day be teaching at a top university. His mother, Benita Parker, also worries. Going back to his college days, she has asked him the same question after every season. Are you done yet? And Urschel will answer, No, I still have some more football left in me. People who encountered Urschel as a child generally came away with two impressions. One, he was a very smart boy. Two, he was a very large boy. His parents, his father a surgeon, his mother an attorney, divorced when he was 3. Raising him as a single mom in Buffalo, Parker bought him math games at Toys R Us, but he quickly conquered them. She bought games for higher age groups, but he mastered those too. Her son's brain became increasingly costly. Parker challenged him at stores to quickly calculate the amount of change he was supposed to receive. If he was correct, he could keep that amount. After a few weeks, we had to stop that, Parker said. It was just too expensive. One day, she taught him how to play chess. That didn't turn out well for her either. He quickly became better than me, she said. Urschel was an equally astute athlete. Though his size was problematic for youth football, he couldn't play Pop Warner because he weighed too much. He couldn't play for his middle school because the circumference of his head exceeded the capacity of the team's helmets. Urschel played lacrosse and soccer instead, waiting until his freshman year of high school to play football. Why did he yearn for football? Urschel admired his dad's success in college football at the University of Alberta, where he played linebacker but became a surgeon instead of pursuing a pro career. Also, Urschel enjoys physical contact. I love hitting people out there, he said. Urschel turned down scholarship offers to play at Stanford, Princeton, and Cornell, choosing Penn State for its combination of big-time football and solid academics. I never wanted to have to make a choice between football and academics, he said. They were both important to me. So Urschel studied math, and he played for Joe Paterno. He made straight A's, and he was drafted by the Ravens in the fifth round. I have never had a student like him, said Zakatinov, Urschel's Penn State math mentor. And though Ivy Leaguers and gifted minds are found throughout professional sports, there are few professional athletes like him in history, with a gravitas and pure genius that go beyond the extraordinary. There was Bill Bradley, a Rhodes Scholar who played basketball for Princeton and then the New York Knicks before becoming a U.S. Senator. Mo Berg, a baseball player in the 20s and 30s who graduated from Princeton and Columbia Law School, spoke multiple languages and became a spy during World War II. And Byron White, who led the NFL in rushing in the 1930s and later became a Supreme Court justice. But none of them, even White, endured the relentless and violent hits to the head that today's NFL players live through. Urschel says he has calculated the risk. I understand this could be a thing, and I recognize it completely, he said, but I accept the risk. So far, he has suffered just one concussion. He said his dad, now 58, is doing well after playing college football at an intense position. Urschel doesn't worry what his life might be like when he's 60 or 70, and he says he's not playing for the money. He lives frugally, driving a 2013 Nissan hatchback. I think for a lot of things in life, it's less about the length of time and more about cherishing the time you have, he said. And let me tell you, I'm living an amazing quality of life. I get to play football, I get to play math, I get to play chess. Urschel began taking chess seriously during his junior year at Penn State when the football team manager was looking for an opponent. Urschel saw connections between chess and football, thinking about the other guy's next move, blocking out distractions, having a plan B. It wasn't long before Urschel was watching both SportsCenter and ChessCenter, an online chess news show that airs on chess.com. And now, three seasons into his NFL career, the notoriety of being a professional football player, math PhD, student, chess player, has turned him into a peculiar celebrity. Urschel is the advanced stats columnist for the Players Tribune, an online publication started by former New York Yankees star Derek Jeter that publishes first-person essays by sports stars. He posts a math quiz every Wednesday. The questions recently included, what is the smallest positive integer, not definable in fewer than 12 words? No hyphens. Good luck figuring the answer out before Urschel provides it a week later. The explanation sometimes runs several paragraphs. Ravens fans are proud of their genius lineman. One fan even mailed him a physics textbook. Urschel, who reads math books to relax, wishes more fans would send books. If you have an advanced text you no longer need, Urschel asks that you mail it to the Ravens training facility at One Winning Drive, Owings Mills, Maryland, 21117. He promises to read everything. In chess, Urschel has been invited to play against some of the country's best players, including a charity event this spring against Fabiano Caruana, the third highest-rated player in history. Urschel resigned less than 4 minutes into the game. But he got to hang out with Caruana and Robert Hess, a prodigy who earned his Grandmaster title at 17 while playing football at Stuyvesant High School in New York City. He was actually more excited to meet me than I was to meet him, Hess said. It's just unbelievable how much he loves chess. Hess lives in New York and runs thesportsquotient.com, a new site for sports geeks. Urschel regularly visits him to talk chess. Hess prefers football gossip. This summer, walking home from brunch, a street hustler pegged Urschel as a good mark for a chess game. Urschel was game. He took black. The hustler took white. Big man coming to play, the hustler said as Urschel made a move. The hustler's other commentary consisted of, and that's a good move, fella. The lineman won. It did not go that well at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County, where the match between Urschel and the Belgian butcher was arranged by the Washington Post. It was not exactly a fair fight. Urschel has a provisional rating of around 1,600, good but not grandmaster great. Rigoire's rating is much better, 2,496. Even so, Urschel took it about as seriously as a Sunday NFL game. A few hours before the match, Urschel FaceTimed with Hess, going over potential openings. The lineman lost the first game, but commanded the butcher's respect. There were some moves I was impressed by, Rigoire said. They decided to play again. Round two, Urschel declared. Redemption. It was silent for a while, then went back and forth. The butcher cracked a smile. What? The lineman said. I'm getting the bishop, so I'm very happy, the butcher said. The lineman resigned. Can you show me where I went astray? He asked. They put the pieces back on the board, setting up an instant replay in slow motion. This was originally published in the Washington Post. On the health and science page, a maximum limit to the human lifespan. Many scientists believe that the first human who will have lived to the grand old age of 150 has already been born. Advances in medicine and sanitation have consistently pushed up the average lifespan over the past century, with a baby born today in the U.S. expected to live to 79, up from 50 in 1900. But a new study suggests we have already hit our maximum longevity, and that life expectancy probably peaked in 1997 with the death of the world's oldest person ever, 122-year-old Jean Calmette of France. Geneticists at New York's Albert Einstein College of Medicine analyzed two international databases on age and found that after decades of increases, the average maximum age plateaued in the mid-1990s at just under 115. We cannot break through that ceiling, study leader Jan Vig tells NPR.org. Describing Calmette as an outlier, Vig believes certain biological limits cannot be overcome by technological and medical advances. Our DNA and cells naturally accumulate damage over time, which eventually leads to the failure of crucial bodily functions. Rather than focusing on lengthening lifespan, Vig argues we should focus on extending our healthiest years through exercise, eating healthily, and perhaps taking drugs to fix some of the cellular damage. There's a good chance to improve health span, he said. That's the most important thing. California's mysterious fault line. The residents of Southern California live in constant fear of the big one, a long overdue devastating earthquake on the San Andreas Fault. Now seismologists may have discovered why they've been waiting so long. While conducting experiments at the Salton Sea, a lake near Palm Springs, a team of researchers found a previously unknown fault line running roughly parallel to the San Andreas Fault. They speculate that the Salton Trough Fault, which remained undetected because of its lack of seismic activity, may be absorbing some of the tectonic strain from its much larger neighbor, perhaps explaining why the southern section of the San Andreas Fault hasn't produced a major earthquake for 300 years. The discovery doesn't mean the big one is any more or less likely, but by learning how these faults interact, geologists may be able to improve their earthquake modeling. To aid in accurately assessing seismic hazard, the study's lead author, Valerie Sahakian, tells CSMonitor.com, it is crucial to correctly identify and locate faults before earthquakes happen. And moving right into the talking points page, evangelicals, why so many support Trump? It will take a long time to assess the full extent of the damage wrought by Donald Trump on the Republican Party, said Jeff Jacoby in the Boston Globe. But one thing's for sure. Buried among the post-election wreckage will be the moral credibility of the religious right. Trump represents the antithesis of most Christian values. A brash, boastful man driven by money, power, and fame, he has had three wives and has openly bragged about his infidelity. Yet rather than opposing this grotesque nominee, most evangelical leaders have enthusiastically supported him, even after he was caught on video boasting about groping women. Some argue that the issues at stake in November are much more important than Trump's moral failures. Others even claim the flawed candidate is proof that God works in mysterious ways. Have religious conservatives completely shed their principles? Sadly, evangelicals really don't have a choice but to support Trump, said Eric Metaxas in the Wall Street Journal. If Hillary Clinton is elected, she'll appoint Supreme Court justices who will further enable abominable abortion practices and clamp down on Americans' right to religious freedom. As odious as Trump is, these issues are quite simply deal breakers. But that argument makes no sense, said Eric Sammons in TheFederalist.com. By forgiving Trump's greed, adultery, fornication, and misogyny, religious leaders are damaging the very thing they are trying to advance, Christian values and beliefs. If Trump wins their support, they'll have no moral authority left. As Jesus put it, for what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Not all evangelicals are falling into line, said Laurie Goodstein in the New York Times. Trump is commanding only 65-70% of the white evangelical vote, compared with the 80% that went to previous GOP nominees. Non-white evangelicals overwhelmingly support Clinton. Indeed, this election has exposed the growing fault line between the older white men leading the religious right and an increasingly assertive crop of younger leaders, minorities, and women. The former remain fixated on outlawing abortion and preserving religious freedom. The latter see it as their Christian duty also to care for immigrants and refugees, the poor, and the environment. Evangelical Christians have long been the GOP's most unified and reliable voting bloc. If these divisions continue to widen after November, it could reshape national politics for years to come. Bob Dylan's Nobel, does he deserve it? Bob Dylan can be called many things, folk legend, voice of his generation, and now Nobel laureate, said Jim Fusilli in the Wall Street Journal. The Swedish Academy honored the iconic singer-songwriter last week with the Nobel Prize in Literature, citing Dylan's creation of new poetic expressions within the great American song tradition. Dylan is the first songwriter ever so honored, and the first American to win the literary prize in more than two decades. Critics are howling at the perceived slight to traditional writers, but whether it's the poignant blowing in the wind or a storytelling tour de force like Hurricane, Dylan has long demonstrated he is a master of American colloquial style. The Nobel judges have been accused of pandering to the masses, said Alan Mace in CNN.com. But a lot of the best art is popular, and for decades we've been morphing from a print culture to an audiovisual one. By honoring a songwriter like Dylan, the Nobel Committee is simply moving with the times. Sorry, but Dylan's work just isn't literature, said Stephen Metcalf in Slate.com. Yes, his contribution to the world is insuperably large, but unlike the greatest poets, Dylan's words can't stand alone without the animating power of music. They're inert. No question Dylan is a great folk artist, said Tim Stanley in the Daily Telegraph, but compare him with the past laureates like William Butler Yeats, Andre Gide, and Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and the thematic density of their texts outstrips Dylan by light years. If the Nobel Committee wanted to honor an American, it could have chosen a literary giant like Don DeLillo, Philip Roth, or Joyce Carol Oates. This is the Nobel Prize in Literature, not Sweden's Got Talent. Oh, please, can't we just bask for a little while in this one? Asked David Remnick in NewYorker.com. Let's not torture ourselves with any gyrations about genre and the holy notion of literature. Dylan embodies a bardic tradition dating back centuries before the printed word, to the Greek epic poets and the psalmists. Personally, I was entranced the first time I heard I Want You at age 7. And decades later, I remain happily lost in Dylan's musical and lyrical world. It has offered me something magical and mysterious and human, imbued with a sense of freedom and possibility. It has been that way for millions of others, and that's part of what the Nobel honors. And we'll round out the hour with a quote from Adlai Stevenson, quoted in the Montreal Gazette. He says, "The hardest thing about any political campaign is how to win without proving you are unworthy of winning." And we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you have enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service would like to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5188. So long until next time.